Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The day today is March 28th, 2023, and this is episode 372. I'm the host, Mark Ames, and you're listening to Radio War Nerd at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd, where you can subscribe, support the show, get newsletters, and so on. Anyway, and I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the War Nerd himself. John, how's it going?
Hey. Okay. It's I've finally had a, you know, I'm not in pain as much anymore from this damn tooth, so been able to get around Glasgow, and it's been really illuminating. When I met up with a bunch of RWN fans a few weeks ago, they talked about the Battle of George Square. In fact, to do a Thomas Friedman, the taxi drivers talk about the Battle of George Square. Most people seem rather pleased with it. Basically, it was in 1919. There was a general strike in Glasgow, which was at that time a really big industrial city. As everyone says, this is like the one fact that everyone remembers about this. Churchill put up machine guns in George Square, which was the central
That is so
square.
Churchill.
Like, yeah, that's Churchill. God. There could be a sitcom called That's So Churchill. So I finally walked down to George Square. It's a nice square. But the main impression you get is that this city and Scotland in general had a very impressive 19th century, because it's like, there's Robbie Burns, there's Walter Scott, there's, I don't know, all these other Scottish heroes. And you move away from that square and the statues diminish. But this was clearly the kind of the intellectual center of Britain in the 18th century, and to a large extent in the 19th century as well. The general strike in 1919, though, it wasn't as bloody as Churchill probably wanted it to be. There were only a couple of deaths. I think one cop died a couple of weeks after getting a brick thrown at him. But there was a general strike in Liverpool at the same time where there were a lot of deaths. In that sense, Liverpool was always a more disposable part of the UK than Glasgow. The empire depended heavily on the loyalty of at least the middle class of Glasgow.
Liverpool was a very Irish and the center of slave trade too, right?
Liverpool was. I mean, it still gets that kind of treatment. I mean, there was a big scandal when a football crowd stampeded because they'd been pushed into a small corner with a fence. It was 1989, the Hillsborough disaster. But yeah, there were 97 dead. And the worst of it was, I think, for Liverpool people, is that some major tabloids said it was their own fault. And, you know,
because most of the people who died were from Liverpool. I'm just reading that here, right?
Yeah. And they were dumb yobs, they were drunks,
right.
That's why it happened. And it turned out that was wrong. They were just ordinary football fans, and they got pushed into a hopeless corner, and they died. The Sun, for example, had a story called The Truth. Some fans picked pockets of victims. Some fans urinated on the brave cops. The brave cops. Some fans beat up a constable giving the kiss of life. So yeah, Liverpool is like the redheaded stepchild of the, not coincidentally redheaded stepchild of the proverb, getting much the worst beatings. But yeah, Scotland, the good thing about Glasgow is that it's very proud of standing up to Churchill in the 1919 industrial problems. And the great part was Churchill supposedly wanted to bring in troops, but he was told by people who knew Glasgow, no, there's a Scottish regiment, at least one, in Glasgow, and if you send in English regiments, they will march against them.
That's too bad he didn't do it. Why did they stop him?
I know.
I mean, I'm just surprised he didn't want to use poison gas right away. Because yeah. That's the most Churchill thing imaginable.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they, I guess it wouldn't have been politic to call them primitive tribes. He said yeah. Poison gas was best against, quote, right. Primitive tribes, meaning right. The Kurds in that case.
You know, he used them. He also used them in Russia in the Civil War when the Brits came in on the side of the whites in the Civil War. That was
he
a
did?
Little known. What? Yeah. Used poison gas and actually opened up the first concentration camps.
Wow.
Where they kept Russian soldiers, you know, and some of the Red
well, they,
I guess
they,
some there of the was, Red Army guys are like, this is a good idea. We might be able to use this someday.
Sneak in a piece of paper and take notes.
Draw a map of this thing.
Yeah. You know? Well, there's the Boer War thing, but you know,
I know. Yeah, I'm just saying, yeah. He had that reputation already. But God, good for Scotland then, you know.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah.
In general, I like Glasgow a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. the weather is pretty amazing. I mean, I'm too old for this weather. You know, if I was young, I'd still have that.
Yes.
Wallace Stevens' attitude, cold is good, spring yeah. is bad. But yeah. I'm way too old for that now. And
the cold gets to your bones much more easily now.
Yeah.
Like, clothes don't do as good a job as they used to. Sort
no.
of. Look
no,
at me like in my overcoat with the collar up, you know, looking like serious.
I sometimes feel like the pilot light has gone out. Like, you know, can somebody, you know, just take a lighter back there and yeah. see if. But, I think most mornings it's like 3 or 4 degrees. It's supposed to get warmer in a couple of days. But if you stay indoors, it's okay.
Sounds like it could be even chillier than we're in Rochester, where I am. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the spring comes late because it's a right. Very marine climate.
Yes, that's the difference, the marine climate. So Iraq. I mean, we can't let the month end before getting in our last shots about this for now, the Iraq war. You know, it's kind of surprising. I think there's actually been fewer retrospectives on the 20th anniversary. It's almost like the people who've been on this, on just, you know, trying to remind people of the horror that was the Iraq war and how much it's still present in our elite political intellectual DNA, you know, media DNA. I think they feel like half defeated because it hasn't, I don't know, it hasn't led to anything. It is very frustrating in that way. It nobody paid. I mean, we've said this before yeah. and you just got to say it again. Nobody paid, no matter how many times you remind them. It just, you know, I would just say this. I mean, It does help in some small degree, at the very least, to always remind people of this and who was doing this. It does help. And yeah. even if they don't collapse, I mean, John, you know, we've talked about this a lot too. Like, there was this, what should have collapsed is the idea, which was very strong and very hard to disabuse oneself of, that if you prove somebody wrong, prove somebody important lied, you show them up as hypocrite, that it will have some kind of magical effect of changing things. And mm-hmm. I think by this point, we understand that it doesn't, you know? And so we kind right. of have to rethink what the whole kind of structure of like, of the relationship between, I don't know, media, politics, the elite layer to the rest of the country is like, and just our myths that we've had about accountability and...
Yeah, well, I think hypocrisy shaming, as people have said, isn't that effective. And I've been trying to think about why. And I remember what someone who was writing, I think, for the Christian Post said in response to a question about some pastor who'd been caught doing something sleazy. And the response was, well, that doesn't matter. Christian values are Christian values. And the fact that person A or person B or person X didn't live up to them has no effect because the values are not incarnated permanently in one person. They exist as a sort of ideal, and you can shoot down any number of people who claim to exemplify them, but the belief in them won't be affected at all. I mean, I remember thinking, ah, that's a scary story. I mean, and if you proved like half of the people who were claiming those virtues were bad people, that wouldn't affect it. But yeah, I kind of think not. If you have American nationalism or American exceptionalism as a key value, you can probably live through any number of hypocrisy revelations.
But it's worse than that because preachers who were caught with their pants down or snorting coke on, you know, with their gay prostitutes. I mean, they actually, their businesses suffered, their reputation suffered. Yeah. And the media people, but they all advanced. They're the only ones that advanced. So it's almost like something else is going on as well. I mean, yeah, calling out hypocrisy, though, is, I mean, the weakness of it is it kind of merely is calling out like a moral failing. This is kind of worse than a moral failing and on so many levels.
Definitely an intellectual, and for me at least, this is something else I wanted to say, like it was an aesthetic failing. I mean, maybe this is just a very snotty Berkeley response, but I was reading, when we were preparing for the show, I was reading Maureen Dowd's article on Bush's mission accomplished speech, and it was all framed in terms of Top Gun, and it was supposed to be sexy or something, I don't know. And the idea that you would quote Top Gun, make Bush into the Tom Cruise character, and make it all seem sexy and exciting, that was just very embarrassing. I realized that there was a gap of sensibility between me and many of the people who had previously seen themselves as liberal, because they bought into a lot of this "I love a man in a uniform" thing.
Yeah.
I remember it was Rob Reiner who made that movie A Few Good Men, which for me was a big gap opening point. Yeah. Like, if that's your idea of a nationalist military movie, then you guys are crazy, and I'm getting off.
And lame.
Yeah. Oh, which, so lame.
Yeah. Like, I don't know how else to put it, but lame.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll get into something soon because it, like I said, just because it didn't have the effect one would want, it doesn't mean you then give up or stop talking about it. You got to keep, you know, throwing rocks at that castle anyway. So one of those rocks might bunk one of them in the head one of these times. And it annoys them at the very least. I know it annoys them being called out. They hate it. Yeah. And it doesn't affect them, but I'm sure it annoys the hell out of them. They want us all to forget. So we shouldn't forget. But yeah, it's the lack of the earnest kind of major premise that a lot of people, I mean, and myself to some degree, but others to a much bigger degree, kind of carry into this. Like, I remember I reviewed this book for the New York Press back in the 2000s. It was called The Record of the Paper by Howard Friel and Richard Falk. What's the subtitle? How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy. I actually found an old copy here. And so I did a review on it, and it was like everything in the book was right, but except for their therefore assumptions. Like basically the main case that the book makes is that the New York Times, being the most influential newspaper, is not adhering to international law on its editorial stances for the Kosovo War. And it kind of brought things back to Vietnam and, you know, and Nicaragua reporting, but it really focused on the Iraq War and the Kosovo War. And the idea is if they had followed what is international law and sort of based their arguments on the kind of moral certainty and legal certainty of international law, they would not have made these mistakes and they would have done things differently. And then we wouldn't have had these wars. See where the therefores get really weird. Like, first of all, they're not going to follow international law. If the political and, you know, intellectual elites are not following it, they're not going to either. Their whole job is to come up with all kinds of rationalizations. And what, are they going to punish themselves? I mean, it's the idea that, like, we can scold you and you will change your behavior. And it goes back again. It raises a question, like, I think a lot of the reason why people believe this will and should happen when you're called out for lying and failing, there should be consequences, is because there were some cultural consequences in the 70s for getting Vietnam wrong and getting some of the worst kind of like excesses of the empire wrong. A lot of those people seem to get moved up, but then we had Reagan a few years later.
When you consider the difference in the way centrist liberals think about Trump and George W. Bush now, it becomes clear that for them, Trump is as condemned as he would be for a Calvinist minister. Like, he is bound to hell. That is his eternal destiny. Whereas Bush, in their weird, weird minds, has become somebody who can be redeemed because he wanders around being nice and showing up at presidential pancake breakfasts, you know, and helping to make eggs for people, and he does it with an idiot grin on his face. So there's something about what does and what doesn't get you out of the club forever.
Yeah.
And something about crudeness.
Norms. That's the thing. They kept talking about norms. And norms, it's everything else, international law and all this other stuff. It's bullshit. It's norms. It's norms because I guess if you look at it again, if you or I were in the ruling class, like in the heart of the ruling class, really powerful, sensing that power, like children of nepotistic, wealth and power, it would, the rest of the country, the other 330 million people who aren't part of my group, it would be kind of scary. It would be kind of like, how do you keep them enthralled? And it's sort of by the magic of the office and the magic of the quote unquote dignity of the office. So that's, I think that was the thing that Trump violated
really
so deeply.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because he had no dignity, and they loved that. They loved that. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people who are maybe, if you like, on the left, loved it in a different way too. So I admit there are moments when Trump violated decorum that I was sort of chuckling.
I think
because we all wanted
all
to
all sensible
that
people were chuckling at certain points.
We were holding hands across the aisle in one big circle. Even though we hated each other. And it's funny, but that I've been thinking of Russian literature before the revolution. There's a lot of that deep fear of what the provinces are thinking and what's going on in their heads. Sologub, the Silver Dove, where there's secret cults being developed and who knows what they're going to do. And there's a poem, I think, can't remember who did it now.
Well, in a sense, Dostoevsky's serfs who get these, I mean, right, these kind of serfs who get these, like, bad ideas, you know, as they start thinking for themselves outside orthodoxy and kind of the hierarchy of things, they become extremely dangerous.
There's this poem that I can't remember the author now, but it's, I don't know, like Pyotr Ivanovich stares at a tree and sees a peasant shaking his fist at him in the tree. He looks again and there is no peasant in the tree. He looks back and there's the peasant again, shaking his fist at him. And they were having this feeling like, am I hallucinating this or is there something scary up there? And in the long run, it may not have been that scary. They managed to bring it on themselves in the most insane possible way by wars of choice.
Yes.
Because I think it's safe to say that France would not have bled out just to help its ally Russia in the way that Russia bled out to help France.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was noblesse oblige as they saw it. So, yeah, there's this fear that the common people don't react the way we and the elite do.
Yeah.
And they can't be predicted. And they seem very nice, but don't pet them. Enjoy them from across the way.
I sometimes felt like, I'm sure this isn't true, but, you know, the first place where I felt like I really saw total unaccountability was Russia in the 90s. I mean, just, you know, gargantuan theft and degradation of everything and corruption and even getting caught out never led to any consequences globally or otherwise because they were with the right team Washington DC, team Clinton, and the Clinton people running that had, you know, nobody paid for that giant failure. And I sometimes felt like a lot of people sort of learned at some point, well, if we screw everything up, like, who's going to make us be held accountable? Like, what am I going to, why would I hold myself accountable or somebody, you know, who works with me, why would I hold them accountable when I'm also guilty of 10 different things? Cause that's how I got here. Like, why would we hold each other accountable when we can just sort of, I don't know, utter some homilies about accountability and move on and talk about how we have to move past this. And, you know,
as long as the money's in a hard currency and it's offshore, there's not going to be any accountability, which I gather is happening in the U.S. elite too. There are a lot of grumbles from voices among the great unwashed that, Hillary's and Trump's grandchildren are all learning Mandarin and they all go to the same schools and keep their money in the same places. I don't know. But if I were a member of the American elite, I would be tempted at least to put a side bet on collapse.
Yeah, they're funny too. They can't help themselves. I mean, again, we'll get back to Iraq, but, you know, again, it's so amazing that the Biden administration, the Biden presidency has gone, as poorly as we thought it would. It started off surprising, but it was hard to believe it was going to go that way. And basically that faction of the ruling class sort of thought, wow, something's really broken here because how else would Trump come into power and Hillary lose? We really need to do some big things to woo people back. I guess we've made mistakes. You know, there's not been accountability. There's been nothing but austerity for all these years. People have suffered. We really need to change things, impact people's lives like noticeably better. We got to offer all these things. And he had such a huge grand program. And literally within 3-4 months after he took office, it was like, we can't do that. And we shouldn't, because we're going to have to raise taxes on the people who backed it. And they're like, you know, we don't need that anymore. And they just dropped the whole thing. And it's like, no, we actually don't need that anymore. And Trump, maybe that was just a one-off and we got it contained. And anyway, who wants to have their taxes raised?
I mean, this actually leads back rather easily to the question of media response to the Iraq war, because we talked a little bit about Bill Keller, who was the editor of the New York Times in the lead up to the war. And I was just looking at his wiki page. He's the son of a chairman of General Motors. I couldn't believe it.
As Walter, I think as you quoted Walter saying, you know, these rich fucks, they're all these. I mean, it's so true, man. Every time, especially in the media. I swear to God, there's more nepotism in the media than any other profession, I can imagine.
Yeah, like poets, for example, were, even in my day, I was just real stupid. Either they had a trust fund or they were stupid because there's no income. And I saw an interview with someone, sort of a, one of these grizzled old guys of the media, getting asked, what would you tell a young person trying to go into journalism today? I'd ask them if they had a trust fund.
yes.
If they don't, they're not going to be able to make a living. I can imagine that the media now does select for people who already got that trust fund.
Yeah.
But here's what, here's a quote from Bill Keller, who greased the skids for Judith Miller and her co-writer Gordon in the lying lead up to the Iraq war. And the smugness and calmness of it is really frightening. We reluctant hawks may disagree among ourselves about the most compelling logic for war, protecting America, relieving oppressed Iraqis, or reforming the Middle East. But we generally agree that the logic for standing pat does not hold. This is the old, it's better to do something. Do somethingism is, as we've said, always wrong. Much as we might wish the administration had orchestrated events so the inspectors had a year instead of 3 months, much as we deplore the arrogance and binary moralism, that's as if, oh, you know, Bush and those people, they have to talk about good and evil to the simple folk. Yeah. We are above this, but they need such consolations. Anyway, we deplore the arrogance and binary moralism.
Yeah, but this is decorum again, right? So that's, yeah, what matters to these people.
Yeah, and it fits in with norms, very decorum. Well.
Yes.
There is a norm for us, and there is a somewhat looser norm for the ordinary people. But he finishes by saying, much as we worry about all the things that could go wrong, we are hard-pressed to see an alternative that is not built on wishful thinking. And the extraordinary thing about this is that they continually invoke wishful thinking as if the peace advocates were guilty of wishful thinking, because they underestimated the danger of Saddam Hussein's regime. That was exactly wrong. Saddam Hussein's regime collapsed within 3 weeks. And when he was finally found, he was hiding in a spider hole with no phone, no communications of any kind. He couldn't have run a neighborhood paper route from that place. But what these people did not think about, because of their own wishful thinking, was the possibility of guerrilla war. I mean, that's been intellectually the most striking thing.
Yes.
When you go back to elite reactions or anticipations, rather, of the Iraq war, nobody in that group was thinking about guerrilla warfare after an occupation. It's astounding. I mean, because people were thinking about it, just not them.
No, that's a really good point. The one thing, when they thought of a potential downside, they thought it could spark some kind of regional war. But that didn't really sound as scary in a way, right? Because it's like, okay, then we'll have set piece wars where we can defeat other even smaller set piece armies. I mean, when you say you're going to get caught in a guerrilla war, in a protracted, ugly guerrilla war, nobody wants to be involved in that. There's nothing. I mean, everybody know it just means incredible violence, no glory, no sort of resolution, nothing really resolved. Like you basically just have to kill everybody. Yeah, here's from George Packer, big figure in this. He's a big promoter of the moral imperative to support Ukraine. And today he wrote these big pieces for The Atlantic on how, like, all of our civilizational aspirations and all of our Western morality are embodied in Ukraine. So he doesn't really change his shtick ever. But anyway, here's the liberal quandary over Iraq in the New York Times Magazine 2002. And he tries to boil down what the sort of pro-war versus anti-war arguments are among liberals. Against war, one, containment worked for 10 years. Two, we shouldn't start wars without immediate provocation and international support. Three, we could inflict terrible casualties, and so could Saddam. Four, a regional war could break out. Anti-Americanism could get worse. Five, democracy can't be imposed. Six, Bush's political aims unknown. Seven, America's will and capacity for nation building are too limited. Eight, war in Iraq will distract from the war on terrorism and swell al-Qaeda's ranks. Well, a lot of those against wars were right, but nowhere does he say guerrilla war.
No,
you know?
No.
Yeah.
It kind of dances around it like, you know, Bush's aims are unknown is reminiscent of the remark attributed to Petraeus. Like, it's Petraeus supposedly said to a reporter on the ground in Iraq in the early days, "You tell me how this ends,"
right?
Because there was no clear ending for it.
Which recalls Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
When you talk like that, it recalls Vietnam, right?
So, yeah. But nobody was much worried about that because I think they were kind of crazy in love. I think this is something we kind of have to talk about. They were, all of this was, and I'm not one of these Freudian, you know, people, but all of this was really sexualized in a weird way. I just want to read some of a Maureen Dowd column in the New York Times from May 4th, 2003, just after Bush did his incredibly cheesy landing on that aircraft carrier. And this is where intellectual limitations and sensibility problems merge for me. Because first of all, if you thought Top Gun was a good model to imitate, I mean, if you wanted to go to war in that era as people out of Blade Runner, okay, I might have been sensitive. I might have fallen for that. But Top Gun? No. But anyway, here's what she says. "The tailhook caught the last cable, jerking the fighter jet from 150 miles per hour to zero in 2 seconds. Outbounded the cocky, rule-breaking, daredevil flyboy." Now, there's no one on earth can string together a set of epithets like this. The cocky, rule-breaking, daredevil flyboy. It just reminds me of a Simpsons episode where Lisa is sort of crushing on the sullen adolescent who works at the library part-time, and she says, "If only someone could tame him." So, daredevil flyboy, a man navigating the highway to the danger zone, out along the edges where he was born to be.
Wow.
The further on the edge, the hotter the intensity. It almost rhymes at the end. I mean, God help us. That's Maureen Dowd. That's the New York Times. And she finishes, "This time Maverick didn't just nail a few bogeys and do a 4G invented dive with a MiG-28 at a range of 2 meters. This time the Top Gun, capital T, capital G, wasted a couple of nasty regimes and promised this was just the beginning." I mean, it reminds me of that moment where our Kindle got stolen on a bus in Albania. And somebody used it to buy, this is painful to admit, a romance novel that was called Sealed with a Kiss, about falling in love with a Navy SEAL. I actually tried. I figured, okay, this is probably good for the show. But it got too sad. But wow. But in the meantime, I read a couple of pages of it, and it was like this. This is Maureen Dowd, New York Times.
My God, that's funny. Oh boy, yeah, we're doomed. It was bad. There was that love affair. There was, I think you're absolutely right, that sense among liberals. You see this in a lot of old accounts, actually in Packer's account and in Packer's account of different liberals. They're trying to ask themselves, or openly ask, like, you know, we can get involved. We can, like, Bush should listen to us because we could make this war better. Mm-hmm. We can make this more like Michael McFaul. A lot of his pro-Iraq invasion stuff was sort of like, Bush's only problem is he needs to be more explicit about democracy promotion. He needs to listen to the liberal internationalists so that we could be partners, you know, and we can make you better. You need us, you know, just please say you do need us because we're here ready to help. And they were kind of falling all over themselves to prove that they weren't afraid of war. What they were afraid of was doing it wrong in some way, but which meant like not doing it according to their norms, according to liberal norms, which would be like basically putting a humanitarian gloss on the whole thing.
That's why I think when you said decor/decorum,
yeah,
I think that's a very good image for this. Like, yeah, this war has good bones, but you got to let us, you know, do the makeup.
Yeah.
But I mean, it all seemed to work out for them. And God was their gloating. Because American troops entered Baghdad on April 9th. The war began March 20th, 2003. And by April 9th, they were inside Baghdad and they staged that toppling of the statue of Saddam in Fifth Square. So the outpouring, I'm sure you remember it, Mark, the outpouring of shut up, you unpatriotic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, naysayers. Yeah, I think the word naysayers actually got used by somebody famous because now it's all done. I mean, Bush has landed on the carrier and said mission accomplished. Giant banner saying mission accomplished. Cheesy as hell, but they didn't mind cheesiness. And now we have actually taken Baghdad. And we have done what had become by that time a kind of magic rite, which was the toppling of the dictator's statue. I mean, you'd seen this in so many wars before that I think many people thought it would have a magical power. I personally think magic is much more popular than it's admitted to be. And I think people really believe that once you pull down that statue of Saddam, that would be it. In fact, I got to be honest here. I think I visited the statue garden in Moscow with you guys, and when I saw the statue of Dzerzhinsky, I was scared of that thing. I mean, I didn't like that thing. So I kind of buy into this myself. But there was what they were not afraid of. Once again, and this is astonishing, what they were not afraid of is guerrilla war, and it started fast.
Yep, it started within a couple months.
Yep.
Just before we get to that, I do want to say, before we get to the guerrilla war, I just want to sort of put a cap on the Bill Keller part here, because you were quoting from this infamous Bill Keller article. This is from this is a month before the invasion, February 2003. The I Can't Believe I'm a Hawk Club. Mm-hmm. And what he says in here was, and this is repeated by many people on the liberal side, he says here, Kenneth Pollack, the Clinton National Security Council expert whose argument for invading Iraq is surely the most influential book of this season, has provided intellectual cover for every liberal who finds himself inclining towards war, but uneasy about Mr. Bush. And Pollack himself wrote, and so he's not the only one. I mean, even like Matthew Iglesias, who was pretty young at the time, but he had said that he was sort of persuaded to support the war by Kenneth Pollack's book. And Pollock himself, I think on the eve of the invasion, said basically something like, this is our only chance to go to war on our terms. If we don't invade now, then there's no more chance left ever until Saddam drops a nuke on America, period. Mm-hmm. Like the kind of argumentation. And then you fast forward about 3 or 4 months later, it's June 20th, 2003. And here's Kenneth Pollack in the New York Times opinion section. Headline, Saddam's bombs? We'll find them. I swear to God. Yeah. And where are Iraq's weapons of mass destruction? It's a good question. And unfortunately, we don't yet have a good answer. In the meantime, accusations are mounting that the Bush administration made up the whole Iraqi weapons threat to justify an invasion. That is just not the case. .. So, and then 1 month after that, Bill Keller gets bumped up to executive editor of the New York Times. Wow.
I mean, yeah, I know it's probably gauche to cite the Onion in a praising way, but the Onion has done some great stuff.
Yes,
and
yes.
20 years later, the best description of the discourse on the eve of this war was two talking heads on the printed page, one on the left saying, well, no, if we invade Iraq, that will stir up civil war between Kurds, Shia, and Sunni. It will destabilize the whole region. There are populations there that want control back. If you displace them, like the Iraqi Sunni, you will create a situation like with the Pashtun in Afghanistan. They're used to being in control. If you take that away from them, they're going to be angry. And the counterpoint was this sort of weasley-faced guy saying, no, it won't.
It just won't. I know. Yeah, and that was it. Yeah, I mean, there were like Andrew Sullivan at that time he was among the gloaters too, that, you know, this proves that, you know, these places where there are protests, these people are essentially a fifth column. They're not real Americans. Of course, he's not American either. and I think he had a quote, we will find the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, he's a kind of canny guy, clever guy, because he was one of the first righties to turn on the right sometime in, I don't know, 2004 or five. He jumped before others did. So he kind of salvaged his reputation so that he could go on and promote race intelligence theory racial eugenics. So wasn't that nice?
I mean, the casualties of this media war were never the people who'd pushed for war, because they, with very few exceptions, prospered no matter how wrong they'd been. The casualties were people like David Kelly, the UK chemical weapons expert, because he wrote a report saying the WMD threat had been, quote, sexed up, which is an interesting phrase, by the way, considering there really was a lot of sexiness.
Yes.
I mean, remember, this was a time when people thought the show Home Improvement was kind of sexy in a domestic way. So anything is possible. He got stitched up by the UK tabloids, who can hound someone to their death. I mean, the Olympian gods' gadflies were nothing compared to the tabloids. I actually talked to someone whose brother had been a tabloid target for one day. He was considered a love rat, and it was on the pages of all the tabloids like the Daily Mail and the Sun and stuff. And he said his brother was, you know, just like Sylvester the cat when he walks into the room with the kangaroo in it, walks back out white as a ghost. He was never the same. So this guy got tabloided, and he was a scientist, a abstemious kind of polite, shy person. And he walked into a neighboring wood, cut his wrist with a pruning shear, except there were maybe, well, and took a bunch of pills and died. So it was either suicide or something else. But there were a lot of casualties like that. because mm-hmm. when you go against the group's decision, and the group that mattered had already decided, it's really unpleasant. It's remarkably unpleasant. And yeah. You can die of it.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about some of the other people who were pushing for the war at this time, or do you want to?
Yeah.
Let's just quote some of these people here who were supporting the war when it counted. When speaking, you know, these are the same people that pontificate endlessly about freedom and, you know, freedom of conscience and all this stuff. Like, you could have actually spoke up once. Mm-hmm. And maybe in your own tiny way, maybe put a little stick in the spoke of the machine as it was, you know, lurching towards war, but you didn't. So here's again, New Yorker editor David Remnick. He wrote, you know, his case for war, his case for invasion, January 26, 2003. He got bumped up to editor-in-chief of the New Yorker after getting Russia completely wrong in the 90s. You know, we talked about him in our series mm-hmm. on Yeltsin's bombing of the democratically elected Russian parliament in 1993. And Remnick supported Yeltsin's coup against the parliament, saying you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. And he had claimed that in 1997, Russia had this great future. It could never go back. You know, next year, Russia collapsed. The year after that, Putin took over. Anyway, here he is in 2003. The United States has been wrong politically and morally about Iraq more than once in the past. Washington supported Saddam against Iran and overlooked some of his bloodiest adventures. Overlooked? We were
literally like via satellite.
Yes, exactly. pointing. The price of being wrong yet again could be incalculable. So it's like we were wrong in the past. Nothing bad happened to us as far as I know, you know, and then the price of being wrong yet again could be incalculable, could be. This is that whole 1% doctrine. History will not easily excuse us but actually history will, so long as you're wrong with the right crowd. Well, history, yeah. Who's history? History is you and your buddies. History will not easily excuse us if by deciding not to decide, we defer a reckoning with an aggressive totalitarian leader who intends not only to develop weapons of mass destruction, but also to use them. I don't know where you get that from. Saddam's abdication or a military coup would be a godsend. His sudden conversion to the wisdom of disarmament, almost as good. He actually did disarm, thinking he didn't want to get bombed. That's the joke.
I think it's worth mentioning this, especially for people who are too young to have lived through this. All these people say, and if there's a hell, they will go to it for saying this, I would love it if Saddam abdicated or gave up his weapons. And you can tell they are saying, oh God, please don't let Saddam abdicate or give up his weapons. Come on, Saddam.
Nothing
give us a
pissed
reason.
Them off more than the weapons inspector saying we can't find anything. Yeah. You know, they got blue balls, like they're just screaming for this war. It's the most ridiculous thing. Yeah. It is a fine thing to dream. God, that fucking tone. It is a fine thing to dream. Patting you on the head for your simplistic belief that this war is a bad idea. But assuming such dreams are not realized, a return to a hollow pursuit of containment will be the most dangerous option of all. Containment, the most dangerous of all.
It's so strange because these are the people who are mouthing childish, simplistic cliches. The ones who were, the few who were, not few. The ones who were opposing the war were saying, look, Iraq is a compound of three peoples who have historically gotten along pretty badly. It's been under the control of one of those groups for a long time. If you dethrone that group, you're going to destabilize the place. And that group, the people of the Sunni Triangle, it was as it was called at the time, are not going to take it very kindly. That was a real point. That the level of abstraction in this is like a million times higher, a million times more childish and simplistic than what the critics of the war were saying.
You know what's interesting, actually? It shows that the mentality of, so people talk a lot today, myself included, about sort of online brain, right? Where your whole worldview is formed by your fights or tribal sort of, you know, spats with other online people, and then you think that's reality. And that's exactly what he's doing here. Like, he's not even, for Remnick, his reality is not what's happening in Iraq, what a war there would be like, what forces it could unleash. That's not his argument. His world, his opponent in his mind are other New York liberals who aren't for war.
Yeah,
and that's it. That's the only battle right there, is that one. So
yeah,
it's very online before you have an online fight.
And I think the New York thing is really important in this too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been a shock to me just reading this over. It's like the only people who are allowed to talk in this argument on TV and in the media, the print media as it was at that time, still are overwhelmingly based in New York. They talk to each other. They don't really believe in anybody else. And yeah, so the literary editor of the New Republic, Leon Weiseltier, I think, he has an even more exaggerated version of this, because he was mainly a literary guy, and Iraq probably wasn't real to him in the first place. So in his argument, as you said, it is literally all about the United States. He said in March 2003, "So can a liberal support this president in this war? I do not see why not." Nobody has ever said, "I do not see why not." Just say, "I don't see why not." "I do not see why not. The United States, its needs and its duties is larger than any of its leaders. The war against Saddam Hussein is just, and it is truly a last resort." Well, first of all, just wars always win. Just wars are a good idea. I mean, there are a lot of peoples of the North American continent had a just war against the people who were trying to steal their land.
Yeah,
it didn't go well. But anyway, Saddam Hussein has been in violation of the Security Council for 12 years. It is in his unrestrained contempt for the United Nations, and not the Bush administration's restrained contempt for the United Nations, that may destroy the institution. There were some Republicans who despised Bill Clinton as much as some Democrats despised George W. Bush, but they supported the American interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo, and therefore they rose above politics to history, above sectarianism to Americanism. This is one of those things. See?
Like John Williams' musical score? I mean, God.
Yeah. "I cannot imagine any strenuous construction of liberalism that does not include the injunction to fight terror and to fight genocide. Liberalism is not a philosophy of innocence, and it should make tyrants quake, not smile." And it's as if, you know, you should say at the end of this, "And when we come down out of the metaphors, what happens? You know, what happens there?"
I mean, it's also, in theory, it's supposed to be very enlightenment. It's supposed to not be stupid. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, that seems pretty basic among everything else in that list there. Like, I don't think tyrants, you know, smile at liberals. They hate them, I think, as a general rule or whatever. But like, you're not supposed to be stupid. I don't know what else. God, these people. Yeah.
No, it sounds like small town clergy. There's a lot of that.
There is a lot of that. Yes, a lot of that. Got to say, there was a lot of that pushing for intervention in Kosovo too.
Yeah.
From a broader spectrum of liberals.
Yeah, but that, that's a really interesting point, because underneath all that moralizing was a sense that we're picking on Serbia here, and Serbia's worn out, demoralized, tiny birth rate, not many soldiers. And most people are sick of this nationalist shit that Milosevic was pushing. it's going to be easy. They didn't stress that. They stressed the moral stuff. But underneath that was a calculation that made a kind of grim sense. There was no calculation this time.
Yeah, I mean, Serbia or the former Yugoslavia and Serbia were surrounded by countries that were not friendly to it and were not a threat to NATO or the U.S. or anything. They weren't going to be fed by, you know, people rushing in from Romania and Hungary and Austria to fight on the side of Serbia against NATO or something. So, yeah, it was definitely very different. So Packer has this big article, The Liberal Quandary Over Iraq. He says stuff like, you can find America's new anti-war movement in a bright yellow room four floors above the traffic of West 57th Street. A room so small that its occupant burns himself on the heat pipe when he turns over in bed. I mean, he spends a lot of time mocking anti-war, basically saying, yeah, you know, and liberals were anti-war. We've talked about this, John. That was a blip in time, though. They're really not so anti-war, but the reputation that they acquired for themselves from the 1970s really outlived actual liberalism. He says this anti-war movement has a serious liability, one that will just about guarantee its impotence. It's controlled by the furthest reaches of the American left because they voice unnuanced slogans like no sanctions, no bombing, or no blood for oil. As for what should be done to keep this mass murder and his weapons in check, they have nothing to say at all. Actually, but they had sanctions and weapons inspectors. That what he means is, as for what should be done, you know, to keep basically as for war, they don't want to go to war. That's all he means. This is not a construct. He says this is not a constructive liberal anti-war movement because it's anti-war. And just sort of moving forward. I mean, I just want to read a little bit of. So he later apologized or kind of did a mea culpa. One of the ones about, let's see, in November 2001, but it's not really, a lot of these guys' mea culpas were not really mea culpas at all. He says, it is easy and completely justified to blame certain individuals. It's always easy. That's very easy. But you try actually lying for war. Now that's hard. I went out there, man, you know, $10 a word in the New York Times Magazine and lied for war. You try doing that. It is easy and completely justified to blame certain individuals for the Iraq tragedy.
I'm sorry, but I'm just imagining Jack Nicholson in a new version of A Few Good Men. I mean, you can't handle the lies. You're not strong enough to take the lies and give them out every day for $10 a word in The New Yorker.
But over the years, I've become more concerned with the failures that went beyond individuals. And what is an individual anyway? And beyond Iraq. And what is Iraq? What is Earth? Concerned with the growing arteriosclerosis of American institutions. That's caused by the war you supported, you idiot.
Yeah, Iraq, you guys could always mass resign or jump off a cliff.
Exactly, I know, and clear up those arteries.
Yeah.
But they stayed there and blocked it. So here's... here he is. I just want to show him today. Right. So here he is in the Atlantic, I think it was. I don't know, sometime in the last few months, sometime in the last year for sure. Last October. So about 6 months ago. The headline is, Ukrainians are defending the values Americans claim to hold. You cannot just remain silent. You cannot remain still. You have to do something. There it is again, the do somethingism, right? In the days before my trip, I had a feeling of nausea that I recognized as dread, not of the place I was going, but of the place I was leaving behind, of the Let's Go Brandon signs and the school board show. See, I got to say that I think of all the lame, dumbass things the right does all the time, the Let's Go Brandon thing, I have a soft spot for that one. I like that one.
Well, if its origin story is true, then it is kind of brilliant. Like, supposedly a crowd at a stock car race was shouting, fuck Joe Biden, and the announcer, not probably out of Biden loyalty, but because he was such a media flincher that he couldn't bear the thought of that going out on air, said, and the crowd is shouting, let's go, Brandon.
I have to admit, I didn't even know that. That makes it even better. And it does, and it's not even particularly disparaging to Biden. Yeah. I mean, it's just funny. It's funny that people get worked up over it. That's the most funny thing, that people like George Packer want to leave America because people say, let's go Brandon. That is the funny thing. Yeah. Of the let's go Brandon sides, the school board showdowns, and the next mass shooting, the prospect that our experiment and people coming from all over to run their own affairs together was finished because they say, let's go, Brandon. For the first time in my life, I felt hopeless about America. That's how I felt when you fuckers got us into the Iraq war and kept your jobs. Anyway, and because I have no transcendent beliefs, the loss of this earthly one left a void of meaning that made me sick. You see how important this kind of like secular small town clergyism is to the elite, the real like blue state, blue check elites. It's very weird, man. I'm telling you, NPR also runs the most tearjerker, mockish segments every day. They love their sentimentality. They're just scary.
Well, because
people.
America has to have a mission. I mean, one of the things that people don't seem to understand is that there were two religions in Civil War America. Well, there was also Catholicism, Judaism in the pockets, at the margins. But really, the two big religions were the Northern Congregationalist New England religion and the Southern roughly evangelical Baptist-y religion. And they had really different views, and they evolved differently. In the South, because of defeat, among other things, religion petrified and became an unassailable fortress for the white South. But in the North, religion melted and suffused into a kind of secular notion of charity, which I'm using in a non-normative sense on account of it isn't often very pleasant. And that's the religion that, in a secularized form, this guy is talking about. And it means, in effect, unless America, imagined as me and my Manhattan friends who have dinner at each other's places, if we don't have someplace to mess with in the world,
yes,
just like, you know, sending Bibles to the kiddies or defusing the pirates or whatever, if we don't have a messianic purpose, secularized but still essentially Christian, then we're nothing. We're just a bunch of rich people.
Just a bunch of rich, powerful people from rich, powerful families who got placed in these jobs. Yeah. I got to continue on this just a little more. Okay. Here was another motive for him going out there. And I just want to say, you know, Ukraine has had and has every damn right to defend itself from an invasion. That's separate. What's scary and has always been scary and has increasingly made myself and a lot of people I know, you know, really, really wary of this war is the way it's influencing and affecting our culture and the back and forth on that. And it's very dangerous. You know, it's like insane. Here was another motive, the strongest and most dubious of all. I wanted a gulp of Ukrainian air. I wanted to breathe its hope. What a thing to ask of people fighting for their lives. Isn't that just wild, man? I'm sorry, but I must gulp your air. You know, I
wonder how it would work on a group of Ukrainians. It's like I can just see a bunch of people waiting for the bus in the slush. And what are you talking about? Are you translating that for real? All right, come on.
Well, at the moment, you know, to the Ukrainians' credit, they've generally all been, a lot of them. I mean, there's also been a lot of media discipline, but they've been pretty, unusual for Ukrainians or a lot of people. They've been, you know, pretty like smart about, they know whose help they need. And so they've been pretty good about it, and they probably would. But like my wife the other day showed me this funny thing going around Ukrainian and Russian Telegram or something, and it shows a comparison. I mean, I'm sure it's all manipulated, but it's still like it rings true and it's pretty funny. A comparison between how this middle-aged American woman responds to a compliment versus a Russian. And so There's like this middle-aged American woman, looks like kind of more working class, perhaps is meant to be looking like that. She's out somewhere and somebody compliments her shirt and she's like kind of very shy. It's like, oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And then there's like this Russian woman, sort of, you know, the type with layers on, it's in the snow holding the paketi walking. And somebody says, you know, Zvini Spajolsta, like, and compliments her clothes. And the woman, as she keeps walking, looks at her and says, Ты чё, блядь, пидорас, блядь, сука, блядь, вот отсюда, бис отсюда, блядь. You know, and Russians love this one. They think it's a funny, yeah. And it is very funny when you see it. Yeah. Just basically like, fuck off, you fucking weirdo. Yeah. And, you know, worse things than that. You know,
well,
so
that, yeah, that's what I mean. It's not that they're not fighting bravely, and it's not that they don't have the absolute right to fight, but that the idea that a very reasonable grimness about the world is going to dissipate, and they're going to listen to talk about Ukrainian air.
Yes,
it seems unlikely.
Yeah, no, it's totally fucking absurd. It's insane. And then he had another one after that. I think that piece got a lot of play and people were like, oh my God, Packer and the whole neocon liberal interventionist thing is really coming back in a big, big way, which is one of the things, I mean, we've talked about this since the very beginning of the war, of the invasion last year, that, you know, that's what's happening. But this is kind of the most extreme example. And then here's Packer, December, a couple months later, December in the Atlantic, an article called A New Theory of American Power. The United States can and must wield its power for good. I mean, you could just cut and paste that to 2003, 2002, 1999 for that matter. It's just like zero has been learned at all.
They were kind of had an enforced timeout period.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Because the Ukraine war is in itself a just cause, repelling an invader, they think that this time, no American combat troops, just cause within certain limits, even granting NATO interference and such, that they can now do the same tunes with complete safety, because they're not claiming weapons of mass destruction. I'm sure a lot of pundits would be really glad if weapons of mass destruction were used in Ukraine, but they're not claiming it. They're not going to have to explain the casualties in America. And the template is there. The template has always been there. I mean, I force myself to read the New York Times every day, and it's something like glee about this war. Kind of really unpleasant to watch.
Yeah.
And overwhelmingly, their subscribers want more. They're really euphoric about it.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Have a sense that their own destiny is tied up with the destiny of American power. And what you said, I mean, I've heard this from people who work in Washington numerous times, you've said almost word for word what they've said, who don't like the foreign policy elites but have had to work with them, which is their lives are meaningless unless they can tinker with the world. You just can't take that right away. And this came around at a good time for Biden, because Biden started off 2021, the first kind of 3 months, you know, like racing out of the starting line, and all this huge program that he was going to do and transform politics, and the most progressive president either ever or since FDR. And that was done. Like, it was clear by early summer that was going to be done, and it was formally done by, I don't know, August or September. I mean, it was so fast. I've never seen anything fall apart that fast before. It's like, you know, it was like the Challenger trying to get up. It's just gone. Yeah. And then, if you remember, I don't know, by December of 2021, there were already articles about the Biden presidency already kind of spinning without purpose and not going to be able to get anything done. And they were already kind of writing it off, you know, well, at least it's not Trump, but, you know, this presidency is pretty much dead now. And then the war came and gave everybody a purpose. And I got to say, it's scary. You brought this up, John, and I really think this is the thing to keep an eye on. And you read Packer and stuff, that if things start going a lot worse for Ukraine, Ukraine's military has held up really well. I mean, you know, two pretty tired old countries bashing each other, grinding each other down. But if, for example, Ukraine's military, I mean, they've taken a lot of casualties and they are substantially smaller than Russia. And if they start to collapse, it is very easy to imagine that the Packers and the world that he's in, which is the foreign policy elite world, media, political, intellectual elites on the East Coast, they're going to say, we got to get in there and prop them up. You know, maybe start with some air power or something, but like, they're not going to just let it collapse like that. There's a good chance they won't anyway. It's pretty scary.
It's a really interesting kind of double thing because it will be framed, if that does happen, it will be framed as a pure moral imperative.
Yes.
We have to do something to stop this from happening. Yes. But there was
a
question.
Do nothing, right?
No, but there was a question that anti-war people asked in the lead up to Iraq, which was, well, why not North Korea? Or why not Iran? And the answer was, shut up.
Yes.
But behind that answer was, because we can't, okay?
Yes.
Because it would be dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, Michael McFaul the other day, he thought it was so clever. He got it from somebody else. He's like, okay. Because he keeps arguing over and over, this has nothing to do with NATO expansion. There's just people that keep putting out that lie that it has nothing to do with NATO expansion. It's just, okay, even the head of the CIA was saying that NATO expansion will trip that wire this, you know, this war 15 years ago, but whatever. And then he's like, okay, I got one. If this is about NATO expansion and that's why he invaded Ukraine, why didn't he just invade Finland and Sweden too, huh? Nailed ya. It's like, because he can't, you know, it's pretty goddamn simple. Like he can't. And I don't even know what the hell that means. It's insane. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's always, so there's always a calculation about power, often a mistaken one, but a calculation. And then it's holding the ground for a moral imperative. But the moral imperative is never allowed to float free. Mighty, mighty few people of the millions who claimed the USSR was the sum of all evil, mighty, mighty few of them wanted a war with the USSR push for a war with the USSR, because that would have meant annihilation for everybody. There are no pure moral imperatives, but there's concealed calculation. So I think we should sum up what happened in the first months of the war, because things happened really quickly. Yes. They were talking. All these pundits were a-chatting, but more serious people in Iraq were doing things also. Basically, the United States and its straggly coalition made a lot of disastrous mistakes in the early months of the occupation. First of all, they claimed it wasn't an occupation, which was not fooling anybody. Then they fired on demonstrators in the
Fallujah.
Heart of the, yeah,
right?
in Fallujah,
yes.
in the heart, yeah, heart of the Sunni.
I got to say, I remember that when that happened. Because the country was still relatively shocked and awed, and there wasn't really activity. And I remember my talk with you then when that happened, and you said that because, the U.S. military, the soldiers there got scared. It's classic. Mm-hmm. Got scared and shot a bunch of people and killed a bunch. Was it killed 17 and wounded 70 protesters?
Yeah.
And you said, this is crazy. This is going to lead to, guerrilla warfare here. And I remember thinking, like, I was skeptical, I have to admit. I mean, I believed it would happen eventually. I didn't think that would lead to that. But that's where it started. Fallujah. I mean, yeah. That did do it. So, yeah, you called that.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, you shouldn't have sent troops into Fallujah without knowing a little bit about its history, because those were nobody to mess with. Right. And they humiliated them, and with predictable results. There were a few developments. The attacks in Fallujah for most people, the Blackwater contractors strung up as charred corpses on a bridge in response. Then an anti-coalition insurgency started, and it started with a bang. Clearly, these were professionals, because Paul Bremer had insisted on disbanding Saddam's officer corps, who might have been willing to work as mercenaries for the occupiers. But now they were out on the streets, and other people were willing to hire them, like Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So sophisticated car bombs hit the Jordanian embassy as traitors to the cause, the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad, which killed the UN leader in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, a Shia shrine in Najaf, killing an important Shia imam. These were the first moves by al-Zarqawi, who had inherited, it was from Zarqa, and Zarqa's an interesting Jordanian city, big Chechen population, displaced Chechens. And he wanted to pursue a sectarian war. There was a lot of disagreement within al-Qaeda about that, but he was all for it. He was going to provoke the Shia into fighting the Sunni and thereby destroy the occupation along the way. But even though there were all these scary, scary things happening, the punditocracy in the U.S. was looking for one thing. Yes. Let's get Saddam.
Yes.
We're going to get Saddam.
Yeah.
And on December 13th, 2003, just before the end of the year, they captured him in an operation called, and I kid thee not, Operation Red Dawn. Operation Red Dawn captured Saddam Hussein. And as I said before, they found him in a hole, just a spider hole, nothing in it but a little food and water, no communications, no link with anybody outside it, in a field near Tikrit, his home base. Now, if there had been real pundits, and this to me seemed important at the time, but if there had been real pundits in the U.S., like people who both knew what they were talking about and were willing to say so publicly, that would have meant Saddam had nothing to do with the insurgency. You cannot run an insurgency from a one-person spider hole with no communications in the ground. You cannot do that. But no one thought about that. They had their second mission accomplished moment.
Yes.
And they said, well, mission wasn't quite accomplished, but now mission accomplished.
Well, they'd all convinced each other that the insurgency was this kind of magical thing. This is so medieval thinking, actually. It was this magical thing happening that was powered by the magic of Saddam not being captured. And that once he was captured, it would be like, oh, he's not a god. And it would be like, I don't know, capturing the emperor of Japan or something. And so everyone would give up at that point because he had this magical hold. I mean, it wasn't like he was loved in Iraq anyway.
No, kind of that's the
so
thing.
Stupid. I mean, yeah. You know, oh my God, they caught him. You know, we better give up and just like start shopping at Target now because the Americans are right. Like,
I mean, they could have seen this too. I think there was a lot of dereliction of duty because people must have known this. If you were old enough to live through the first Gulf War, you remembered that Saddam called on all his alleged followers worldwide when he first started to get in trouble.
Yeah.
Now, my pretties, fly! Attack! Attack the Americans wherever they are. Nothing happened. Yep.
I know. It's like, oh.
Nothing happened. Yeah. Now, if Hezbollah had done that, or a group like that, or Al-Qaeda, something would have happened. It might not have been successful. I mean, the military operations by guerrilla forces fail a lot of the times, but stuff would have happened. With Saddam, nothing happened because he didn't have anybody out there in the world. He had clan loyalists, and to a certain extent, he had an officer corps that profited by him, but that was it. Nobody was really eager to die for Saddam.
Yeah. I just have a quote here. Ezra Klein, who's a New York Times columnist now and the founder, co-founder of Vox, in 2003, when they captured Saddam, here's a quote. "I am ecstatic that Saddam was captured. I strongly supported going to war in Iraq for humanitarian reasons, and he was the cause of those humanitarian problems." And then here's Ezra Klein 8 years later, 2011, quote, "I supported the Iraq war based on the argument that Saddam Hussein was an irrational tin pot imperialist who would use weapons of mass destruction the moment he got them." So it kind of changed the story a little bit.
Yeah. There. Oh, they all changed their story. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, Paul Bremer, the complete imbecile head of the occupation, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we got him." They love, by the way, in mm-hmm. D.C., they love that mix of registers, like the formal archaism of "ladies and gentlemen,"
yes,
and then the pseudo-streetiness of "we got him."
Yeah.
It hurts my ears.
It's very like 1940s Hollywood cinema kind of thing,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, that mixture of formal and...
Clark Gable could do it. But Bush again proclaimed the kind of magic you're talking about, that in fact, Bush sounds here like something out of a swords and sorcery book. Quote, "In the history of Iraq, a dark and painful era is over. A hopeful day has arrived. All Iraqis can now come together and reject violence and build a new Iraq." Yeah. Well, it wasn't quite that simple. And I think we're going to have to finish soon, but I think we should the second development, and this was the back break. Well, there were the back got broken many times, but the next one was the people that we were allegedly saving, the Iraqi Shia, rose up against the occupation in April of 2004, and this is what Seth Harp was describing in our interview in the last episode, that his convoy was attacked by the Mahdi army, which was Muqtada Assad, his force, his militia, basically, a Shia clergyman. And that wasn't supposed to happen. Like, okay, the Sunni Iraqis, okay, they're Saddam's people. Officially, they hate us, but we'll turn them around with good treatment. The Shia are just going to fall over themselves, thanking us as liberators. And then 6 months into the occupation, they attack in masses. I mean, they didn't attack the way Zarqawi's people did, with carefully constructed bombs that could be placed right by a few people. These were mass infantry attacks.
Yeah, it was kind of like a Tet moment, wasn't it?
That, yeah, very Tet. Sense. Very yeah. Tet, yeah.
Because I was in America, I remember when that happened, and I won't lie, because I was so against the war and so against the people who were for the war and the whole crazy fucking culture, that when I saw this happening, it was like, well, you feel kind of vindicated. Like, you know, yeah. You're watching it and you can't stop watching it, and you're flipping from channel to channel because it feels kind of good to be vindicated and,
yeah,
you know, sorry for the whatever the other soldiers that were on the other side of that. But, like, what the hell did you expect? And it went on. And boy, man, I've rarely seen instances of cognitive dis. I guess the only thing that could be compared to it was was Trump's victory and the way that that just shocked the hell out of, but that shocked really just one part, one faction, big faction of kind of, you know, the elite and others. But this was like the entire mediating class, you know, political and media class was just, and it came like boom, boom, boom. It was this. And then Seymour Hersh came out with the Abu Ghraib story and the photos, all like within a week or two of each other. And the torture scandal came out. And then Fallujah happened. So it was just like, this whole thing is coming undone so fast. And it was so clear that the whole thing was barely stitched together in the first place.
The WMDs failed to make their appearance too. Yes. And no matter how many rationalizations were invented for that, and there were many, it was getting hard to juggle rationalizations for all these epistemological failures, let's say, at the same time. There were just too many balls of flame to be juggling. And it was, you could not say, if you knew anything about Iraq, you could not say that Muqtada was fighting for Saddam, because for God's sake, Saddam had killed Sadr's father, Muqtada's father. I mean, it was blood feud.
Well, we saw that for reals when they hanged him, right? And they yelled out Sadr's father's name.
Muqtada! Yeah, and Saddam. Yeah, they were calling Muqtada Sadr's name. Yeah. Right. And Saddam was genuinely puzzled at that. Like, Muqtada, that little squirt? What? And that was the thought he took to eternity with him.
I know. that was revenge. I don't know how much more, because before we finish, I have to get in my Michael McFaul story.
All right.
Let's finish with that. You want to finish with that? Okay. I mean, in a sense, I think at this point, people understand the war went downhill very fast. I mean, the one thing that happened, you know, who really cares about the Provisional Council and all this other shit and the surge and, you know, in 2007-8. Anyway, I want to talk about Michael McFaul here, because Michael McFaul, I knew him again from the exile days. He was kind of our fun Clinton villain, because he was the Clinton regime's sort of, you know, policy mouthpiece. And he was the most quoted guy in the Western press in the late 90s, always saying how, you know, reforms are going great, democracy, democracy reforms, called the 1996 elections free and fair, like all that stuff. And then, you know, he was out, his buddies were out of power and Bush was in power, and he was trying hard to make himself relevant. And then he, under Obama, he became for a little while the ambassador to Moscow. It was pretty disastrous. And then he got into the Russiagate thing. I think he really became a major public figure during Russiagate and Trump, as one of the leading Russiagaters, and, you know, helped set up this Hamilton 68 fake disinformation sniffer. And then when the war started, his popularity and it went even more through the roof. And one thing he's been doing since Putin's, you know, full-scale invasion, as they call it, you know, since the full invasion in February 2022, is saying, you know, is trying to deal with people who are saying, well, you did Iraq, because that's also what, I mean, Putin kept bringing up the U.S. invasion of Iraq. So he started revising his own history and saying he never supported the Iraq war. And in fact, anybody who opposed that war, as I did, should also, for the similar reasons, oppose Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which would be, you know, which would have an argument, you know, something to it, if it wasn't from Michael McFaul. So I'm just going to read out a couple quotes here. I mean, let's see, December 2022, as the U.S. ambassador to Russia, I constantly had to answer questions from Russians about our invasion of Iraq, even though I personally had nothing to do with that decision. Even in our inactions, we Americans bear some responsibility. So he's kind of saying, I only bear as much responsibility for that war as anybody else in this room here. And then he says here, I was against that war. This is a quote. But the U.S. leaders at the time did not claim that Iraq had no reason to exist. Or okay, whatever. So he says, I was against that war. And he later says, at another time, For those always looking to keep me honest, you can see here what I wrote in real time about Iraq. And then he does a link to michaelmcfaul.com. Well, funny thing is, michaelmcfaul.com is heavily edited. It edits out a bunch of articles that I found through the Wayback Machine because I remembered them, so I knew what to look for. So, he says, I dare you to find anything. And if you believe that he's being honest and posting everything he's ever written there, there's like a giant gap between the year 2000 and the year 2014 or something,
Yeah.
You might not know. So like here, for example, on the Christian Science Monitor, September 16th, 2002, headline from McFaul, Change the Policy in Iraq. Here's a quote. As the Bush administration begins the process of promoting democratic regime change along a new frontier in the Muslim world, it must also finish the job on the European frontier. He was pushing for regime change in the Soviet Union, in the former Soviet Union world as well. And he was saying, we have to, yes, Bush is right to promote regime change there, but also you got to listen to me. We need to do some regime changes over here in my back, my area of interest. Washington Post, August 2003, after no WMDs found, it's wrong time to stay the course. And he says here, and I quote, President Bush should create a Department of Democratic Regime Change headed by a cabinet level official. The offensive equivalent of the defense-oriented Department of Homeland Security. He wants a cabinet department like Homeland Security or Department of Defense called the Department of Democratic Regime Change. The State Department's mission is diplomacy between states, not the creation of new states. The Pentagon's mission should remain regime destruction. Its formidable capacities for regime construction should be moved into a new agency, which would also appropriate resources from USAID, State Department, Treasury, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, elsewhere there's other articles where he says
I'm imagining a green hit team.
Yes, exactly. No. I mean, the idea that he called himself an opponent of war, but he's saying we should set up a regime change department and replicate what we did in Iraq, only do it better and more and in more places.
As Lou Reed said long ago, you hit me with a flower.
Yeah. Nasty stuff. Anyway, it's stuff that these articles he kind of wishes we had sort of forgotten about them.
Yeah.
But just remember that with McFaul. I remember right around the same time Max Boot was saying we should come up with an actual office of a colonial office and call it that.
Right.
And wear colonial uniforms like the Brits did, and that would help us to rule these places.
Pith both helmets, of these guys, as I remember.
Yes, even pith helmets, you mentioned. Yeah. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And look where they are.
Yep.
Yeah. But anyway,
I hope we've at least managed to revive some of the lively times, the horrific slapstick of this phase of American history. The trouble is, it won't stay dead. In fact, it a lot of people didn't want it to be dead, and they kept digging it up again and propping it up. And it probably always will be propped up until there's no more American capital to do it with.
Yeah, It's really bizarre. I mean, if the U.S. didn't keep doing this stuff and messing up the world, I mean, just if you look at it from a presumably American nationalist point of view and not this sort of class interest, America would probably be, I don't know, far wealthier and more sort of culturally and otherwise powerful around the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember when NASA landed on the moon, and for a lot of the world, that Vietnam kind of spoiled that. And and otherwise, it would have been like a world festival.
Right,
it would have been fantastic.
Right. So they screw it up every time, but you can't. You can take their empire away when you pry it from their cold, dead hands. I mean, can't. You can't take it away from them. And I don't even know how it happens. I know some people sort of pray for like a collapse of America. People have been praying for that for decades now and thinking we're just about there. But all that would happen, were that even to happen, it would just mean like completely disempowering and shitifying the lives of just about everybody except those people. They'd still have everything. Maybe not their empire, but they'd still have tyrannical rule over the rest of us, and they would take it out on us in a big way too. But anyway, I don't see that happening anytime soon, no matter how many screw-ups they continue to do. So we're stuck with them. And all we can do is throw rocks at them. So let's keep throwing rocks at them, you know?
Yeah, I think we threw a few rocks today. That's the best we can do.
Yeah. All right, well,
I mean, you did say the rocks bother them, right?
Yeah,
I
no, they do, because that's why they have to write their fake mea culpas. And you can tell their mea culpas are not mea culpas at all. It's sort of like, all right, I got to have this up there because I have to point to something.
There was even a term, mini culpas, that developed when there was a rash of apologies, non-apologies for the Iraq War around its fifth anniversary.
Most of them went along the lines of, yeah, I supported the war, but not the way he conducted it. Had I known, he would have conducted it that way. Had I known, it's like, that's the thing. In that class, none of them in that layer were like allowed to sort of admit to each other that they knew this guy was a dumbass liar. It was unbelievable how obvious it was.
In some way, in my mind, this is connected with the rash of articles recently, like by A.O. Scott, a sort of a Acela Corridor reviewer, movie reviewer, arguing that Tracy Flick is the true hero of election. I mean, I swear, there have been at least two articles. I think one was by Jill Filipovich. Another was by A.O. Scott.
That was during the Me Too thing. I don't know when A.O. Scott did his, but I remember during Me Too, and suddenly every single woman, including fictional characters like Tracy Flick, who were supposed to obviously be comic villains of a familiar type. Like, they were all victims and good guys now. It was, man, this
is in some way, this is connected supporting Iraq. I may be wrong. Yes. I probably am.
How? Explain
it.
You know,
that's the way it works in these neurons.
Can you explain your theory of election Tracy Flick Iraq?
I suppose it's that Tracy Flick embodies a fierce belief in the norms with absolutely no moral code underneath it. Mm.
Yes, that's well put. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. I think it's a good way to end the show, because that's what rules. I mean, you know, you can be nihilistic about it and say, well, that's how you get ahead, folks, but let's be honest. I don't know. I think if you're listening to this podcast, you're most likely don't have that disposition and feel it's pretty awful to have it. And so we were left with all we can do, which is toss rocks at him.
Yep.
Keep doing it. Yep. All right. That's our
happy throwing, everybody.
Yeah. Look back at the Iraq wars. We remembered it anyway. Crazy, stupid time and there'll be plenty more coming. Anyway, thanks everyone. Thanks John,
everybody.
Brendan, and talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.